me first how you went there. What the circumstances were.
I was a student at the Institute of Design in Chicago in the spring semester of 1951. And I had been studying photography with, well, as a matter of fact, I had hoped to study photography with Harry Callahan at the ID in Chicago, but in fact wasn't able to get into his class, so I had great admiration for his work. So I heard through him that he was going to Black Mountain College in North Carolina to teach the summer, whatever they called it.
Summer Institute.
And that he was also going to bring Aaron Siskind, who whose work I knew but had never met. So I really went to study photography. And then I also heard that Ben Shawn was going to be there. And I knew Ben Shawn from around here, who he had met through political friends. And so I used to go to Roosevelt Village occasionally and see him, sort of 1947, 1948. So I heard Sean was coming. I left Chicago, I guess it was in about the 1st of June, 1951, and I was going to deliver a car to the West Coast, and I drove through Colorado Springs, where I met Emerson Wolfer, a painter who had taught at Black Mountain, and also at the ID in Chicago. And Emerson said, gee, if you're going to Black Mountain, there's this terrific guy going to be teaching writing down there named Charles Olson. I'd never heard of Charles Olson. And he said he was a Melville scholar, and he was great. He was the biggest man in the world. And he was, you know, very interesting. So I, you know, that sounded fine. But I didn't go there because I didn't know who Olson was. And so that was kind of funny, in a sense, because I heard he was there. And so I went on out to the coast. I went to San Francisco and produced the first Jargon book. It wasn't a book, but it was a little broadside of a poem of mine. Printed that in June and got to back to Black Mountain, I suppose, by whenever the thing started, about the 4th of July or something.
This is
51. 51, yeah. And well, it's by the time I got to, I mean, the reason I left Princeton essentially was I was being trained in the art history department, and I never had an English course at Princeton. I didn't study English here at all. I was studying art history. But it seemed like what was going to happen was I'd end up in the basement of the Morgan Library as some kind of Byzantine curator, which didn't strike me as where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. I was interested in painting, and actually, since I was 6 years old, I had drawn and painted and so on. And I had studied in New York with Stanley William Hayter at the Atelier 17, etching and engraving, and I'd studied painting with Carl Knoths at the Phillips Gallery in Washington. So I had a fairly decent background. Unfortunately, my nature was really sort of like, hopefully it was like Courbet. I mean, I was very much in a sort of landscape, rich kind of landscape direction. And in the 40s, it was that was not to be done. I mean, you couldn't paint like that. Knoth was a cubist, and so he flattened me out, and Hayter was kind of a surrealist, and he made me put in all sorts of science fiction type curves. by the time I'd been flattened and curved, I was not interested anymore. Found myself only able to write people's names. Instead of drawing, I was writing people's names and doing calligraphy and things. So anyway, I was into this peculiar world, and my big literary star or hero was Patchen, and Patchen and Cummings, and Henry Miller and Robinson Jeffers, God help us. I mean, those four people were the ones that, and Aldous Huxley, and C.S. Lewis, a strange kind of world, and that's what I really liked. And of course, ultimately, if you read those people enough, you get into Blake. So when I was at Hayter's, the whole notion of producing poems that could be illuminated, so to speak, interested me. So again, here I was at the Institute of Design trying to learn about photography, and I had learned a little bit about etching and engraving and lithography. All of it was kind of leading toward printing books, but I couldn't write poems worth a damn. I mean, I wrote sort of horrible Cummings pageant pastiche, which weren't really any good at all. So it's odd, when I met Olson, he was very almost antagonistic toward me because he didn't admire Patchen or Cummings and thought that this was a very dubious place to begin. So he was really sort of heavy with me. He really ripped the stuff to pieces, which I suppose was maybe good. But it took us about 2 months before we got friendly at all because he, as I say, was inclined to be very, very, very rough on me.
Was he there when you first arrived? I thought he was in Yucatan.
I think he had just come from, if I'm not mistaken, he'd been in Lerma, Campeche.
Yeah.
I think he'd spent the winter there. And if I'm not mistaken, he and his wife and young daughter arrived in Black Mountain just about the time I did, you know, direct from Mexico. So he was there. I walked in the first day, and the person I recognized first was Sean, who was telling, jolly tales from the Hasidim to the uninitiated, and all these heavy things he does, you know. And, he was entertaining, holding court, and there was Olson, who was about the biggest man in the world. I guess in those days he was probably as light as maybe 240. He was certainly a vast spectacle. So I signed up for his writing course, which met, I guess, as I recall, sort of one night a week after dinner. And I do remember one of those classes that summer was started at 7 o'clock. It went till about 11, at which point everybody rushed to Ma Peake's place. Peake's place was the local beer joint. And so everybody loaded up on beer, went back to the college. The class went on all night. It went on all the next day. We went back to Peake's place the following night, and I think there were three people still sort of stumbling about and mumbling at each other, but that class lasted almost 2 days. And that was the kind of experience that Black Mountain could afford or was possible there. And that's, you know, as I say, I mean, I wouldn't have seen a professor at Princeton probably that much in a whole semester. And ultimately, that's one of the reasons I left here, was because I found it so difficult to get sort of hold of somebody in this formalized, you know, structured kind of place. And I didn't like it, because I'd gone to a prep school, St. Albans School in Washington, where I was kind of a fair-haired boy, and, you know, the teacher's time was mine, so to speak. I had two teachers, an art teacher and an English teacher. All I had to do was sort of ask about something, and they would devote a lot of time to me. So I was used to that. So when I came to Princeton, let's say, somebody come in and give a sort of 50-minute lecture, and that'd be the last I'd see them until the next week. I couldn't get at them. They were bored, the students were bored, and I just wasn't getting anything. I spent all my time in New York at the, you know, Abramson's Argus bookshop, buying Kenneth Patchen books and Henry Miller books. That's how I spent most of my time at Princeton, was in New York. That seemed like a very expensive way to do things. So, you know.
Most of the classes at Black Mountain were irregular, weren't they, in time and form and shape. And I know they all didn't last 2 days, but it wasn't like 7 to 10.
No. I mean, I was, for instance, I suppose, if you were going to take a photography class, Siskin would say, well, look, come in Friday morning, and Siskin would be there, and you could work with him. He'd be there for a few hours. And he would take you out. We'd work with the Rolleiflex. I bought a Rolleiflex through him. And he taught me the fundamentals of how to use it. And I suppose occasionally there'd be a sort of class critique. I mean, everybody'd bring in the stuff they'd been doing for the week, and he and Callahan would sort of sit there and discuss it all. I was also studying book binding with Mrs. Jolovitz, and that was very much, she'd sort of be there like Thursday afternoon. You come in and work as much as you wanted to, and you could come in and work independently of her. So, I mean, there people would be there sort of like for an afternoon, and you'd come and go as you felt that you were able to do.
How many were in Olson's class, do you remember? Just a rough figure?
Rough figure, I would think about 10 to 15.
That large?
Yeah, I think so. His only requirement was that you were not allowed in the room and not allowed to speak or participate unless you had a piece of manuscript in finished form to be concluded. So the stuff would be, I mean, you'd walk in the door and you'd throw this thing down on the table, the long seminar table in the studies building. And, well, there'd be, let's see, the summer of 51, Nick Chernovich, well, had been a previous student of his. He was very keen on his work. Victor Kalos. Kalos and Chernovich were really sort of cognoscenti. They had been there before and knew Olson, and he had counseled them, so they were working along lines that he wanted.
Was Fee Dawson there?
Fielding Dawson was there, and he had known him before. I believe there were other people in that class.
Francine, maybe.
Francine was in the class. Francine Duplessis was there. Susie Gablick. Susie later has gotten into art, sort of collage, and very involved with Magritte and surrealism. Now lives in England. But Susie, I think, had known Sean. She was a very young girl at the time. I think Sean sort of became her protector there at the college, something of that sort. But she was a very bright girl. Let's see, who else would have been there? Ed Dorn was at the college, but Ed, I believe in the summer of 51, was not a student of Olson's, unless I'm getting it mixed up. Ed was a scholarship student working at the farm, and he lived over there. And so he was doing that, and God, I don't know, maybe something like woodworking or something. I mean, he was not a writing student. I'm pretty sure I'm right on that.
Is he in England now, or is he in?
No, he's in Kansas.
Kansas.
He's traveling now. He was on the coast. I saw him about 2 weeks ago. He was staying with Harvey Brown in Gloucester since about late summer. Then about 2 weeks ago, he left to go west. I don't know exactly where he's going, but he'll be at Kansas. What is it, Kansas State?
University of Kansas.
University
of Lawrence.
Of Kansas.
Is he there now?
I don't think he's there yet. He's supposed to begin the next term as a poet in residence.
And he'll be there for the whole term.
Yeah.
University of Kansas at Lawrence.
He was there
last spring. He was
last spring, and then went back to England.
Yeah, he was there. William Stafford was there. I saw Stafford and just missed Dorn. Well, Ed and I used to play. Ed was the only person at Black Mountain that could play tennis worth a damn, so I used to play tennis with him. And it's about the only time I knew him, just on the basis of that occasional game.
The Olson class only met once a week, is that right?
Oh, that's my recollection.
Mm-hmm. And everybody had to bring each week
a manuscript.
Yeah.
A piece of text. Joel Oppenheimer, did we forget him? Joel was. Let's see, I believe Russell Edson came down with his sister, Pat, and maybe for a month. Russell had been, and somebody named Tommy Jackson.
Yeah.
A lot of people sat around the edges of the room. It was a small room, as I say, and like Dan Rice would be there practically every time. And somebody named, Mark Hedden. Mark Hedden, Tim LaFarge. I think Tim LaFarge would have been producing things. As I say, if we add this all up, it gets to be like 10 to 15 people at the table. And then, as my recollection, the room was, like a smoke-filled room, and people sort of sitting around the edges or standing. Or
in the studies building?
In the studies building, yeah. So, and this, it usually was a pretty long, very intense evening.
And how would Olson decide, or who decided what shape a particular evening would take? Would he just browse through the manuscript, pick one out, read it, talk about it?
It would start from the particular texts. And
he hadn't seen any of these manuscripts
before. No, I think one of the courses. He had crazy sort of titles. I mean, he'd dream these titles up for the course, which really had no particular significance. I mean, well, for him they did, but I think that course was called Ovid's Metamorphoses and Mayan Glyphs, I believe was the title of that one, summer 51. So obviously he was studying Mayan hieroglyphs, and he was very much involved in Golding's translation of Ovid. So somehow you had to, that accommodated whatever happened to be going on. There was a course later on, about 1954, 55, called The Present, simply called The Present. And that was an interesting one because the triggers for that were literally the daily news. He took out, everybody had to take out a subscription to the New York Times, and I guess the local paper, the Asheville Citizen Times. So before you came to, I think the class maybe met at noon, we would get the newspapers like at 10 o'clock in the morning in the post, and so you'd have to read the New York Times. This was the class preparation. You had to read the New York Times, and you'd have to read the Asheville Citizen Times, and then we would wing it, take it from there. It was the time of the McCarthy trial. Is that what you call it, trial? Or
hearings.
Hearings, yeah, the hearings. And so we'd go and watch that on television. And it was great because, you know, if somebody was making some remark about China, Olson would then say, well, you've got to read four books on China by such and such a time, you know. So you had to do a tremendous amount of work, and you never knew what kind of work you were going to be doing. But you'd have to read Owen Lattimore, and you'd have to read this, and you'd have to read that, you'd have to read Malraux, you'd have to do such and such. And then it's really just based on the nature of the events that were taking place in the world. That was the course.
This was 54, you said? It was later, anyway.
Yeah, it's later. It might be 55. I can't remember. Mm. I would suspect it's maybe 55, because I wasn't at the college continuously. I first went there, as I say, in June or July 1951. I was having a fight with the Selective Service over my conscientious objector's position, and this has been going on for about 3 years already. And that fall I was having more and more troubles with them, and a federal hearing officer I had to appear before in Asheville, for instance. And so I stayed there through, I guess it was January of 52, at which point I finally decided to go into the Army, other than go to jail, because I had refused to be inducted at one point, so somewhere, I think it must have been in that fall, I was called and refused to be inducted. And I was being counseled by Olson, Patchen, Rex Roth, and Robert Duncan, and I think, and Paul Goodman, I suppose. They all decided in my case probably the best thing to do was go in instead of go to jail. So I went in with the proviso that I'd be going to the medical corps. I would be put in the medical corps. And of course, the first thing that happened to me was I was sent to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I was put into a 16-week rifleman company right away. So then there was another crisis, whether to go to the stockade or whether to go to the psycho ward or whether to refuse to take the gun and all that sort of things. And at any rate, we're getting off the subject, but these things were going on, and as I say, I finally did get into the Army and later got into the medics through the intercession of a man named Chaplain Kaplan at at Fort Knox, to whom I sold five copies of one of my books. And he picked up the telephone and said, get this guy out of here, you know, and get him in the medics. So it was that was a very nice gesture on his part. So I stayed in 2 years, and of course, got to Germany fairly fast, got to Stuttgart, where I was put in touch through Olson with Rainer Maria Gerhardt, who had been in touch with Olson and Creeley through Pound. And there were printers there. James Lachlan had used this printer named Kantz, Dr. Kantz, in Stuttgart. And so I went down the hill from the hospital where I was working and started printing books. I printed Maximus, the Maximus poems there.
Is that the first printing of Maximus?
Mm-hmm.
It was.
So that started in production. Well, I must have got there about October of 1952. I got to Stuttgart. and it took about a year to get the book out. But
can you tell me a little more about the background of that, like how Olson chose you to do it, or you know, whatever transpired? I don't know.
Well, one of the things that, besides my own really abrupt about face when I went to Olson's class, as I say, he took me away from the direction of people like Cummings, Jeffers, Rexroth, Patch, and Miller, which was where I was at, and told me to read all sorts of things.
Williams, I'm sure.
Well, Williams, of course, and this was Pound, and this is when Sid Corman had just that summer published the second issue of Origin, which featured Creeley. So one night, you know, there's a package of Origin magazines. Olson is saying, here's this guy Creeley, I want you all to read it. And so we did, and Duncan. I believe he proposed at one point, if I had not been in the Army, if I had stayed around Black Mountain more continuously, there were four people that he counseled me to read, and he wanted me to write sort of long papers on them. Creeley was one. He sort of divided them into sort of, you know, avant-garde and more traditional. Creeley and Duncan were the two people he was interested in most as younger writers. So he wanted me to be associated with them and really get into their work. The other two people were more classic. A man named Lawrence Richardson, who was, I don't know what's happened to Lawrence Richardson. I believe he's an archaeologist. Yeah, he's a scholar and an archaeologist, but he apparently wrote some poetry in those days. And I don't know what's become of him. Maybe the University of Chicago seems to register in my mind. I don't know. Have you ever heard of him, Tom?
No.
Lawrence Richardson. Anyway, Olson was interested in his work, and he's also interested in the work of Merwin at that time. So those four people. I never, you know, I wasn't there, so I wasn't able to do it.
Well, how long were you there the first time?
Well, I was there from July through January.
And then you went to service.
Then I was in the service, and I came back a few times, but like the following summer of, the spring, and I was stationed in Camp Pickett, Virginia for a while. I mean, I came down to Black Mountain a time or two between assignments, and then I was down in Fort Sam Houston down in Texas that summer. So I was in and out of the place a few times, and then I was in Stuttgart for about 17 months. Well, one of the things that Olson had told us during that first summer was, which I really still believe and thank him very much for, he said, I believe his expression was, the artist is his own instrument, or should be. If you didn't, you hadn't, well, it's sort of a Marxian thing, I mean, take the tools of production into your own hands. I mean, we had a print shop, so he said, don't ever be intimidated by the, you know, by the disdain or the disinterest of the world. I mean, get yourself some type, get yourself some paper and print it. So, as a matter of fact, a lot of the manuscripts that were done for his class ended up in sort of small hand-printed editions were presented right at the table. Oppenheimer was printing up things. Joel was printing, I mean, literally, I mean, sometimes the thing would come at the table as a small limited edition of, you know, Rauschenberg would do a drawing, Cy Twombly would do a drawing. I don't know whether Sean did, perhaps, and Fielding Dawson, you know, he was both artist and writer. So we would sometimes produce these things in that way, but the notion was a very valuable one for me, and I still believe that it's true. Also the fact that, as far as Olson was concerned, you essentially, you started from your friends, I mean, you started from the community. Whom you should reach first was the people around you. So we produced these things in not vast editions at all. Maybe 50 copies would satisfy the demands of the college. I don't know whether my thinking has really changed since then. I mean, that's essentially why I make these books. It's to satisfy the demand of a kind of a community which doesn't exist in fact, but exists in people's heads. Because I think we really have a lousy literary community in this country. There's really nothing in it. Everybody's so subjected to paranoia, competitiveness, backbiting. But it didn't seem like that at the time. Of course, I don't think you can ever operate under the assumption that it really is that bad, but it is pretty bad. If you publish somebody, he becomes your enemy. I've discovered this. But seems to be the nature of the case.
Hasn't that community at least stayed together, someone? Really, Duncan Olson, you?
Well, I'm very much, at this point, really on the margins of it. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, I haven't become their enemy, but I'm no longer the friend of many of these people.
You mean a sharp break or simply distance and so forth?
A lot of it's the fact that, well, obviously, the virtue of a place, Black Mountain was literally a place, and the associations are very close and very constant. But if you suddenly are not in one place and there is no community, in fact, then all the separations and distances and divergences, and, well, for instance, my sort of wide-ranging enthusiasm for other writers, I suppose, has been a thorn in the flesh of Olson and Creeley and so on. They would not like the fact that I continued to publish Patchen or Bob Brown or Mina Loy or people that they would consider marginal or idiosyncratic. Then I got into printing. I printed Buckminster Fuller, for instance, who was anathema to Olson.
He is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of me or him. I mean, it was I think they fought almost for power at Black Mountain. I mean, either Fuller was going to get it, or Olson was going to get it.
Well, the only version I've had is that Fuller was offered it and didn't want it. So if it was a power struggle, it was all on Olson's side.
Well, my feeling is that the antipathy was extreme between those two men.
That surprises me very much.
Well, it'd be interesting to check it out.
I haven't talked to either of them yet, so that's probably why I don't know.
No, this was earlier. This was like, Dahlberg, I suppose it was, had Olson invited there. And then I think Fuller was there when Olson arrived, and they immediately sniffed each other and didn't like what they smelled. I don't know the more details than that, but Olson, every time he has a chance to write me or confront me, is always unhappy about the fact that I printed a book of Bucky Fuller's.
Which one was that?
The Untitled Epic. It's called Untitled Epic Poem on the History of Industrialization. I brought this out about 1964. It's a long, 275-page epic poem. Of course, that crowds Olson a little, because he probably figures he's writing the only epic, Maximus.
Yeah.
And so Fuller knocks this thing out, and this probably crowds him. He takes no interest in it at all. The only people who liked the book were Cage, Norman Brown, McLuhan, and the governor of North Carolina, Terry Sanford. They're the only people who wrote about it.
That's it. Is there an extra cigar I could borrow?
Please, sure.
Great. Thank you. Would you tell me about the Maximus poems? We got off of that. How you came to print them?
Well, nobody, there was nobody else doing anything.
Was Olson also, like so many others, having trouble getting published in those days?
Mm-hmm.
He was.
Sure, still is. Still is having trouble. Let me think. My publishing predates Black Mountain, which a lot of people don't realize. I mean, I had done Jargon One.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that.
Yeah, that's pre, this comes out of thinking I was doing in Chicago at the Institute of Design. That's pre-Black Mountain. But the whole direction suddenly changed because, as I say, it was very much Patchen, very much sort of Blakeyan notion. Because of my hater studies with, etching and engraving and all that sort of thing. It was very much along those lines. And I had studied some typography at the Institute of Design with a student of Jan Tischholt, who's a very great designer from the Bauhaus, a woman named Laura Zerner, who's very good, Hugo Weber. They had taught me things about book design. So that's all pre-Black Mountain. So I was, then that summer, we printed, the second Jargon was a little collaboration between Bob Rauschenberg and Joel Oppenheimer, which was produced at the college and given away to people, or maybe cost a quarter, I forget. But
Joel's poem?
Joel's poem, which was dedicated to Catherine Litz, the dancer. It was, I think the poem was called The Dancer, and Rauschenberg did drawings. I believe it was in production that fall. I don't believe we were able to get it out that summer, because, as I recall, we all met in New York at a recital of hers at the YMHA. If I'm getting it straight, it might have been maybe December of 51. So anyway, we produced this thing at the college. Joel printed it. So that was Jargon number two.
Why Joel and not you? When you say he printed it, what does that mean exactly?
Because Joel knew more about printing than I did. I mean, I helped him a bit. But he was...
Mechanics of printing.
Yeah, he was the guy who literally did most... He and Tommy Jackson were the guys who did the literal work in the print shop. And I'd come up and sort of help, but I never learned much about setting type. Or,
yeah.
I would pick paper and...
You were the design aspect.
Yeah, even then. I mean, I was not doing the actual physical work. I was... figuring out what the things to put together, which has always been my consideration. Like what artist goes with what poet. And sort of the way it should look, but I've never been able to execute these things because I never took the time or trouble to learn. Jargon 3 was a series of poems of mine that I wrote on the whole under Olson's tutelage. There were six of them, called Red Gray, Red Virgule Gray, illustrated by an artist that I had known in Chicago named Paul Ellsworth. Again, this is somewhat predating the Olson period. But we produced that in the print shop.
Can I ask this? Why did you put the name Jargon on it? Did you have any hesitation? Did Joel and Rauschenberg, for example, know about Jargon 1? And did they suggest that edition be called Jargon 2?
I just decided that...
It's a minor point, but I'm interested.
No, I just decided... I took the name Jargon for somewhat ironical reasons. Well, there were several reasons. As I recall, the word... I like the word as a word, jargon. I like the sort of irony of the word, because most people would take it as such, you know. It's kind of a rueful comment on the way these things would probably be received as jargon.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, jargon is a kind of psychoanalytic term of the speech of the child before he learns the social language. And I think they use the word jargon for kind of, you know, personal idiosyncratic speech. Well, I like that notion. I think in France, jargon means the twittering of birds. So it had all kinds of funny references in it, it amused me to use that name. So I decided, well, this jargon is going to be used to identify me in some respect as active in the work. So there's going to be like Jargon 1, Jargon 2, Jargon 200, whatever. Anything with jargon is going to be either written by me or published by me or designed by me or something. So that's how that comes to be. So Jargon 4 was Dan Rice and Victor Kalos, and we produced that in the print shop at the college.
Vic's poems? Poems?
Vic's poems. It was a kind of folio, loose leaf folio, six poems and four drawings of Rice's. It was called The Double Backed Beast. For 100 copies. It was almost never produced because something happened. We ran out of money, or I was away in the army, and something happened to the plates. I forget, but anyway, it was kind of a disaster. And Dan Rice produced a few, and that was the end of it.
How much would these editions cost? Do you recall?
Jargon 1 was 25 cents.
You mean each copy?
Yeah.
I meant to produce.
Well, didn't cost very much. I guess Jargon 2, the one with Oppenheimer and Rauschenberg, was probably just a matter of maybe $50, something like that, a couple hundred copies. Jargon 3 was bigger because there were six plates, and the plates must have cost $10 or $15 a piece, and the paper and envelopes and things. But we're talking sort of $100, $200, that kind of thing.
You still have copies of all editions?
I have one or two copies of everything, but that's all. that's all. I think there are only two complete sets anywhere. J.M. Edelstein at the UCLA Library and myself, I think we have the only, perhaps the only complete runs of everything. Unless Jim Lowell at the Asphodel Bookshop, he might. It's almost impossible to get all these early things because they were just given, they were given to our friends, and most of those people are still alive, and these are either lost or still in their libraries.
What number is Jargon up to?
70.
70.
Mm-hmm. It's been doing about 4 books a year all this time. Jargon 5 was a collaboration between Catherine Litz's husband, who came down that summer, Charles Oscar, who later was murdered in New York. You know, he was a painter with the, what's that man's name, Charles Allen, the Allen Gallery. Charles Allen used to be at the downtown gallery under Mrs. Halpert, and then he opened a gallery of his own on Madison Avenue. Charles Oscar was a painter with him, also worked as a book designer for the Museum of Modern Art, and was murdered by somebody. I don't know for what reasons. But
they know who?
Well, it was he picked up somebody in a bar, apparently, when he was drunk and got knocked in the head, left on a rooftop on 3rd Avenue or something. So he was Jargon 5. This was a project which, well, that was the first project done in Stuttgart.
Excuse me for a second, was that OSKAR or CAR?
OSCAR.
CAR.
Mm-hmm. This is about 1960 or 61. Let's think. Okay, I think Jargon 4 was done just after I went in the Army. By the time I got to Stuttgart, that was October of 62. And a friend named Charles Neal had just died, and he and his wife were close friends, and his will left me, I think, maybe $2,000. So when I got to Stuttgart, I thought, well, I'll either buy a Max Beckmann, or I'll buy a Mercedes, or I'll do something about this publishing. I could have bought the Beckmann and probably made a lot of money, but I didn't do it. This was a beautiful portrait there, of, you know, like $850, probably worth $15,000. So here I have $2,000, so I thought, well, what the hell, hell. Olson has this poem he's been writing, this long poem that nobody seems to want to print. As I don't even know who might have printed it. I suppose Sid Corman, but if you look back at Origin, I mean, those are pretty minimal. So sort of set on a barotyper or something. I mean, they're not the kind of productions that Olson would have wanted.
Well, would Olson have considered a place like Partisan Review, or was the problem that they wouldn't consider Olson?
Well, he had a few poems in Partisan Review, but they were very sort of ordinary, sort of Yeatsian poems. He did publish one or two there, I think.
Yeah.
He published a couple of poems in, for instance, Harper's Bazaar.
Atlantic,
he had a poem about the death of a friend who was drowned. Two poems?
There were two and 49.
Yeah, he published occasionally in Partisan, and he published, let's see where else. I can't remember exactly, but I used to have a sort of file of all those things, but it's gone.
Did he try to get Maximus published anywhere?
I believe there was talk that Robert Creeley had been able to get his first book published, his own first book published by the Golden Goose Press, which was run by Richard Wirtz Emerson and Frederick Ekman. They were two young poets from Columbus, Ohio. They'd gone to Ohio State. And started, did you ever see The Golden Goose?
I've heard of it, I haven't seen it.
It was a magazine and also a series of chapbooks. They were very Williams-oriented. They printed a book of Williams called The Pink Church, and they printed Norman MacLeod. Let's see, what else did they do? Oh, I don't know. But anyway, a lot of their work was very much in the orbit of Niedecker. They were printing Loreen Niedecker, who I'm now bringing up, collected poems out. I think maybe Zukovsky even they printed a little bit, but the people that kind of in this Rakosi objectivists, Rexroth, they were interested in. And they printed this first book of Creeley's, I think, which was called Le Fou, which must have come out about 1951, maybe winter of 1951. I may be wrong on that. It might have been the winter of 50. But at any rate, there was this book, of which I once owned two or three copies. And Olson, I believe, was supposed to be printed in a book by them. Now, I'm not sure whether it was going to be Maximus or whether it was going to be something else, but he was really just beginning to write Maximus, you know, about 1950, I think it is, maybe 49. But that's when it was starting to be written. And he was writing it, I know he was writing it the summer of 51, I can remember. You know, he's reading a new one or two. But there was nobody sort of begging for it. And he was, he liked my ideas. I mean, he wanted to, he liked what I was hoping to do. So he gave me that script, which was, what, 10 poems. The first one was letters 1 to 10. So I printed those in Stuttgart, and with this man, Kantz, and it was a very, I don't know if you ever saw that book, isn't it? It's a very big, very handsome book. It came out very well. And then I also printed, when I was over there, I printed, I was working with Gerhard, Rainer Gerhard. He was helping me with the printers. I printed the book of mine called Four Stoppages, which was some very Olson-influenced poetry of mine with Charles Oscar's drawings. So that was Jargon 5. And then Jargon 6 was, Jargon 6 was the Maximus poems. Is that right? Let's think. No, I think, I don't know, maybe Jargon 6 might have been the fables of Kenneth Patchen. Maybe Jargon 7 was
Maximus.
And Jargon 8 was The Immoral Proposition, which is the first book of Creeley's that I published. And this was printed in Karlsruhe at a print shop that that Rainer Gerhard used. And we printed, that was with Lobiès. Lobiès was this painter that Creeley had known in France from Nice, and was also a translator of Ezra Pound, I think the first translator into French of Pound. And Lobiès did these ink drawings to accompany the poems of Creeley. So, as I say, there was this sort of Poundian association, as I say, of Gerhard, of Lobiès, L-A-U-B-I-E-S, Lobiès, Creeley. I went to meet Creeley for the first time in the summer of 53, when I took that photograph. That was in Banyol Bufar, this village in Mallorca. I went down there and spent a week while I had a furlough. And then I went to Nice to meet Lobiès, who put this project together.
How large was the edition of Maximus?
I believe it was 300 copies of the regular edition and a special edition of 25 copies that was boxed and signed. And that took at least 3 years to sell. And it cost all of $2.25 for a book that's, well, I suppose today would cost at least $10 a copy or more.
Oh, I think much more.
Well, I mean, just when you started it out, it's a sort of $75 book now in the rare book market. I mean, just physically, it would probably be a $10 or $12 book. But in those days,
just to produce.
In those days, $2.25, a lot of people bitched and screamed and carried on and said I was wasting. I was making books for bibliophiles, and they didn't have the money. Creeley's book was a very informal kind of Japanese presentation. It was bound with strings, and you sort of flopped it on the table and opened it. It was a table piece. It wasn't, you know, it was not for the shelf. It was a very informal, relaxed thing with these kind of Asiatic-looking drawings of Lobiès. And that was $1.50, and people again, well, what do you mean? It's only 10 poems or something. What do you mean, $1.50? They'll always figure out some reason to dislike things. I mean, I've discovered that. There's always something. As I recall, 18 people bought the Creeley book in the entire United States. And he, between himself and Lobiès and myself, we gave away 182 copies to our friends, and 18 people bothered to buy it. So, You know, it cost maybe $1 a copy, maybe cost $200 to make that book. And we only sold 18. So that, so to speak, is how poets began. I mean, later on at Black Mountain, we did this thing between Dan Rice and Creeley, which was called All That Is Lovely in Men. I think that was 200 or 250 copies. We were able to sell that for fairly fast, for 250 a copy. Then there was something called The Whip, which was a small selected poems that was produced in Spain. Gail Turnbull was actual publisher, and I distributed it in the United States. That was about 1956 or 57. I believe that was 500 copies, and that finally sold. And then by 1960, All That Is Lovely in Men, A Form of Women, that I did with 8th Street Bookshop, Jargon, Corinth Books, of Creeley's. We did 2,000 copies of that, and that sold rather quickly.
How much are your editions now, generally?
2,000. Even Unknown People, I'm going to do 2,000. Just so they'll be around for a while. I don't have any particular sense that, I suppose people buy, I mean, there are more people, so you sell more books, but I don't know how much more interest there is in new poets than there ever was. There certainly isn't very much. But, as Judd Laughlin was saying the other day at New Directions, I mean, the libraries are so much more able to buy books because of all the federal funds that have been dropped their way. A lot of libraries that never used to buy anything are suddenly buying.
Yeah.
So you can probably move a couple thousand copies without much attention.
You said this past week you were doing a lot of foundation, going to and fro. Is this how Jargon survives? Is it through foundation grants?
I never had a grant from
the
about.
Sales can't do it, obviously.
No, it's sales. I never could count on sales. I used to do it by advanced subscription. I would say, I guess I had enough money to do the first Maximus, but wouldn't use it. Well, $2,000 in those days covered Olson's book, which I think must have cost maybe $750, the first Maximus. Kenneth Patchen's book cost about an equal amount, about the Fables of Patchen. It was a good-sized book that cost about that much money. Plus the Creeley book, plus my little broadside book. Four stoppages. I got those four books in for about $2,000. Whereas today, almost any book you do is $2,000 or $3,000 just in itself. You know. But anyway, I got those four things, so I was covered on those. But there were almost no sales from these things, so I was really no further along in terms of financing. So, I think Jargon 9 was maybe Maximus 11 to 22, and I wrote subscription letters to all of his friends, all the people that were interested in the press, and said, send me $3 and, we'll produce this book. And I got, I think there were maybe 50 copies for patrons. I would ask them if they would send me $25, they would get their name printed at the back of the book. So I think I was able finally to get maybe like 25 people in the United States to put up $25 a piece. And that, you know, that was really maybe 60% of the production cost. Might have cost $1,000 for that book, I forget. That was the way it was done. And then there would be like maybe 100 people at $3 a piece, and 25 people at $25 a piece. So that almost got the book paid for. Again, I think that came out in 1956. I think it took about 3 or 4 years to sell all those. It was all $3 a copy. But as I say, people managed to find reasons not to buy it.
You have less trouble with editions now?
Well, yes and no. Now I'm printing people with names like Loreen Niedecker, Alfred Starr Hamilton, Russell Edson, Mason Jordan Mason, Merle Hoylman. And obviously those are not names like Charles Olson, Robert Creeley,
yeah.
Robert Duncan, and Louis Zukofsky. So in a sense, I have as much trouble as I always did, because My function has always been to initiate a few things and not to sit back and reap the harvest. All the rights to the books were devolved back to the writer. I held no rights because this is an adjunct as far as I was concerned. If Olson's correct, and I think he is, if the artist is his own instrument, if I'm part of a community, an avant-garde community, because I happen to have a particular feeling for and talent for making books, I'm just doing that as a poet, interested in other people's work. So I can't hold rights, and, or couldn't. And I wasn't doing it for commercial reasons, obviously. I was just doing it because it seemed to me that it needed to be done, and why the hell wait 10 or 15 years until somebody in New York suddenly decided these things were... I don't think they ever would have decided to do anything. They might have. But
well, as you said, Olson still has trouble.
Olson has a lot of trouble. Creeley doesn't have too much trouble, but he had six small press books before Scribner's was willing to take a chance on him. Denise Laritoff, Lachlan had New Directions, had something of an interest in her work, but until Ferlinghetti and I printed her, he didn't see it. It's his business of people not being able to see typescripts or things that aren't, so to speak, books. Suddenly when it's a book, then suddenly you can see it. I mean, there is this thing. It's kind of mystique of the book.
Grove has now published Creeley's edition of Olson, I don't think. Selected Writings?
New Directions did that one, I think.
New Directions? Well, then it's the Donald Allen one.
Donald Allen one. It's been redone in paperback, I think. Yeah. The Human Universe.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how that book did when it came out. It was a pretty expensive book, $25 book that Andrew Hoyam did on the coast. I don't know whether he's able to sell that or not.
I don't know. It's now the paperback.
Yeah.
It's the same plates, too.
Same plates, probably. That's offset. But I'm not interested in, as I say, I was not interested in starting a publishing career in order to hold people, just to get them onto something else. But it seems, and always seems necessary, to print people in this way. I mean, like the underground presses, the small presses, have to nurture reputations for about 10 years before the broader scene can even be conceived of, thought of. Duncan is more or less in the hands of, if he chose to be, but he has a curious approach to publishing. He doesn't particularly like to be published commercially. He almost prefers to be published by small presses. I do too, frankly, because I like the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, is based on enthusiasm, based on passion, based on desire, not based on boredom or what the sales manager has to say. Hideous reason for publishing.
When did you come back to Black Mountain from the Army? Was that 54?
Well, I got out in January of 54, and as I recall, I stayed around the college until about October. I was there pretty much that whole time. Creeley came, I believe, that year for the first time.
From Mallorca.
From Mallorca.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Duncan was there that summer. Or, I don't know, maybe Duncan was there briefly and went to Mallorca. He was over there for a while. I'm not sure that Duncan and Creeley were in Mallorca at the same time.
When you came back, was it again formally as a student? Or
well,
for some undefined status?
It was kind of undefined. At that point, we had the Black Mountain Review. Creeley had started that. And I was supposed to kind of... I think a little bit later on, we had some notion that I would be something with a title like publisher in residence, and that I would produce books, you know, for the college, and I would publish the Black Mountain Review and so on. I think I'm listed in the last issue of the Black Mountain Review as publisher. I helped Creeley with the physical side of it, with the visual side, helped him get visual material. He, of course, did all the other editing himself.
Who did the actual typesetting? Was Oppenheimer still there?
No, that was produced by Creeley's printer in Palma de Mallorca,
yeah.
Mohsen Alcover, Alcover, it's printed in there somewhere. M-O-S-S-E-N, I think, usually the way he called himself, Mohsen. So. Yeah, all the books in the Divers Press were printed there, and then the review was printed there, exploiting fascist labor.
And then when you left in October of 54, that was it? You didn't
no.
return again?
I went to San Francisco and stayed there perhaps 6 or 8 months. Was very close to Duncan, saw a lot of him. And,
can I ask why you left in October? Was there any special reason, or you just felt time to move on?
Gee, I can't really remember. Seems to me like at that particular moment there wasn't much happening at the college, you know. By that time the size of the place was very, very reduced. There was almost nobody about. Stepan Volpe was teaching music, and of course I was not a music composition student. Charles was there.
Lola Shepherd.
Yeah.
Languages.
Yeah, I wasn't taking any courses much with anybody except Olson. And it was